Leaving cert debacle, department plans to publish source code for calculated grade system. High drama in the US presidential campaign as President Trump contracts COVID. And with COVID cases here on the increase, is the government's spend and save plan for the hospitality sector already dead in the water? All that and more coming up after the news with Vivian Traynor.
Thanks, Katie. Good afternoon. The headlines. US President Donald Trump is in hospital with mild symptoms of COVID-19 as more of his inner circle test positive for the virus. A serious crash in Dublin last night involving a bus has left two people seriously injured and has been referred to GSOC. And ahead of crunch talks on Brexit, Boris Johnson calls for common sense on both sides to secure a deal. US President Donald Trump is receiving treatment in hospital for what the White House has described as mild symptoms of COVID-19. His doctor said he has been given an experimental antibody treatment and the antiviral drug remdesivir. The president was transferred to the Walter Reed Military Hospital last night and will continue with his duties working from there. Meanwhile, his campaign manager Bill Stepien and former White House adviser Kellyanne Conway have also tested positive for COVID-19. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan.
Before leaving the White House last night, US President Donald Trump posted a short video saying that while he thinks he's doing very well, he was going to hospital to make sure things work out. Earlier, he was described as being fatigued but in good spirits with mild symptoms following his positive test for the coronavirus. The president was given an experimental treatment of synthetic antibodies, and the White House said that out of an abundance of caution, his doctors had recommended that he work from the presidential offices at Walter Reed Medical Center for the next few days. Last night, he began taking the antiviral drug remdesivir and was said to be resting comfortably. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's former senior adviser Kellyanne Conway has tested positive for the coronavirus. She was at an event at the White House last week where the president announced Judge Amy Coney Barrett as his Supreme Court nominee. A number of people who attended the gathering have now tested positive for the virus. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, Washington.
Gardaí are investigating a serious traffic accident involving a bus and a car in Dublin last night, which left eight people in hospital. GSOC is also investigating the incident, as the car had come to Garda attention earlier. Our Dublin correspondent, John Kilrain.
It's understood that the Dublin bus vehicle was travelling northbound on Northumberland Road when the accident occurred with a car travelling from Haddington Road. The bus swerved and hit a tree and building, while the car ended up on its side. Gardaí are appealing for witnesses to last night's incident, especially from anyone with dashcam footage. Meanwhile, eight people injured were being treated in St Vincent's Hospital, where two were said to be in a serious condition. It's understood that one of those injured is the bus driver. Today, the National Bus and Rail Workers Union said the incident showed the risks its members faced when they went about their duties. GSOC are also investigating the incident, as the car had come to the attention of Gardaí earlier in the night.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the President of the European Commission Ursula von der Leyen will hold a video call today to try to break the deadlock over a Brexit trade deal. Mr. Johnson said the chances of getting a deal are very good if both sides exercise some common sense. The eighth and final round of talks ended yesterday without agreement, with the main sticking points being fishing rights and state aid. More than 900 household outbreaks of COVID-19 occurred in September, according to the Health Protection Surveillance Centre. In recent days, public health advice to limit social gatherings to between just two households at any one time was extended nationwide in a bid to stop the widespread transmission of the virus between families. Laura Hogan reports.
The latest data from the Health Protection Surveillance Centre takes account of all cases reported up until midnight on Wednesday, the 30th of September. It shows there were 924 family outbreaks of COVID-19 last month. This is a significant increase on 530 household outbreaks in August and 127 in June. At the height of the lockdown measures in May, there were just 94 such outbreaks. The 14-day incidence rate of the virus is now 100.9 for the entire country, with border counties Donegal and Monaghan reporting the highest levels. Health officials say the national situation is a serious concern and have urged people to limit social gatherings to between people from just two households at any one time.
Madrid is the first European capital to re-enter lockdown as it tries to curb soaring COVID-19 infections. New restrictions have been imposed in Spain's capital as around 10,000 new cases of the virus are currently being recorded in the country every day. The new measures restrict movement in and out of Madrid and nine other towns, affecting around 4.5 million people.
RT Radio 1 weather with Ulster Bank. This weekend is the perfect time to review your mortgage. Talk to our mortgage team at a time that suits you.
Dry in most areas today with sunny spells and scattered showers. Showers will turn heavy later in the west and southwest. Persistent rain will develop in the northeast in the evening or early tonight. Highest temperatures of 11 to 14 degrees. And that's all from the newsroom for the moment. Katie.
Thanks, Vivian. Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. Joining me in studio this afternoon, I have Jack Chambers, Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin West and Government Chief Whip and Minister of State for Sport and the Gaeltacht. Richard Boyd Barrett, Solidarity People Before Profit TD for Dunleary. Donnacha O'Leary, Sinn Féin TD for and Education Spokesperson and TD for Cork South Central. He's joining us from our Cork studio. We'll also be joined by Lorna Fitzpatrick, President of the Union of Students in Ireland, and by Elena Fitzgerald-Kane, President of the Irish Hotels Federation. But first, we are going to go over to the United States for that for the very latest on that dramatic developing story of President Trump's diagnosis with COVID symptoms. We've heard there in the news, Brian, as you were telling us, that he is now in hospital and expected to be in hospital for a number of days after that diagnosis yesterday. What is the very latest on his condition?
So the latest we have, Katie, is a late night statement last night here in the US from his doctors saying that he was doing very well and not requiring supplemental oxygen. They said he was now taking a course of antiviral medication, remdesivir. We know earlier in the evening they also told us that he was taking this experimental cocktail of antibodies. The US President Donald Trump himself tweeted after he arrived in hospital saying, "Going well, I think. Thank you all. Love." Earlier, he had posted a short 20-second video to social media saying that he thinks things were going very well, but he was going to hospital to make sure things worked out. And then we saw that unbelievable image, really, I suppose, of him emerge from the White House wearing a mask, getting onto Marine One, his helicopter, to take him to hospital. I was outside the White House as it was all playing out. I was in an area close to the Washington Monument. There was a large gathering of onlookers, a large gathering of media. Witness all this play out as he boarded his helicopter and was taken to Walter Reed Medical Center. It was interesting to speak to people there afterwards. You got this sense that regardless of political affiliation, Katie, there was a sense there of that this was a monumental moment and a sad moment and a worrying moment for a country when they see their leader taken away to hospital. The White House very keen to stress that these are mild symptoms. We're hearing reports of a low-grade fever and that he also has some fatigue. They are telling us that this is just being done out of an abundance of caution. And they're saying that technically he's not really in the hospital. It's not like he went straight to the emergency room last night. What you have in the Walter Reed Medical Center is this huge facility where they treat a lot of soldiers, a lot of wounded warriors. And what you have there is presidential offices that the president can use. And we're being told that he will be working while he is in this medical facility.
Yeah, and on that point, Brian, there was some reporting last night that there was some surprise that he was moved so early on after his diagnosis, because, of course, there is quite substantial medical facilities within the White House itself.
He has teams of doctors around him in the White House, Katie. And that's what's been, I think, worrying for people, that this has changed very, very fast. When he announced early yesterday morning that he had this positive diagnosis along with the First Lady Melania Trump, very quickly a doctor's note was issued by his physician saying that he would be treated at home in the White House and he would work from the White House. And throughout the day we were being told, you know, mild fever, mild symptoms, fatigue. Clearly things worsened at some point during the day and this decision was taken to move him to hospital. But again, it's being sort of played down, just being done out of an abundance of caution. Now what we're also seeing playing out here are several other members of his inner circle starting to test positive as well for the virus. Last night, we were told that it was his former senior advisor, Kellyanne Conway, and his campaign manager, Bill Stepien, adding to a growing list of people in his inner circle who have also now tested positive.
Because, of course, Brian, it was a very busy week for the president where he attended a number of well-attended events.
If you look at this week, it was the president always has busy weeks. This was a particularly busy week, and there was lots of big events with lots of big crowds. This day last week, Saturday, Donald Trump formally announced his nominee to the Supreme Court, Judge Amy Coney Barrett, and he held this big gathering in the White House Rose Garden. There was people sitting together. They were tightly packed. They were not wearing masks. And the TV footage before the event started showed a lot of people hugging and shaking hands. Now we have a situation where the president was at that. The first lady was at that. Kellyanne Conway was at that event. Two senators and the president of Notre Dame University, all present at that event, have now all tested positive.
Yeah, indeed.
We had the situation where his senior advisor, Hope Hicks, also tested positive, and she had been at several events and on travel with the president all week.
Yeah, it's really an extraordinary unfolding story, Brian. They've announced that Mike Pence, the president, is still in charge, that he hasn't become incapacitated to the degree that the vice president would take over the reins.
Yes, they have said that Donald Trump is still in charge. There has been no transfer of power to the vice president, Mike Pence. As we say, they keep telling us that Donald Trump will be working from this Walter Reed medical facility. And interestingly, last night, we also got a medical note issued from Mike Pence's doctor saying he had tested negative, that he was perfectly fit and healthy. He hadn't been exposed to anybody who has the virus, and he will not be quarantining and will be carrying out his normal duties. Lots of other big names have also been coming out saying that they tested negative. Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential candidate, of course, he shared a debate stage with Donald Trump on Tuesday night. He tested negative. So too did Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. She said that her tests have come back negative.
And do we know, Brian, if contingency plans are being made at the White House in the event that the president's treatment is more protracted than is now being portrayed?
I mean, they're certainly not saying that publicly. All they will say publicly is he is in charge. These are mild symptoms. No transfer of power. One would imagine that, yes, in the background, they must be. There must be planning going on about the next steps here and what is going to happen. And of course, today is a very significant day in this sense. It is exactly 1 month to the US election. And Donald Trump's election campaign plans have now been absolutely thrown asunder. He was already behind in the opinion polls. He was fighting hard to try to close that gap. He was planning lots of campaign events. Yesterday, he had a packed schedule. He was supposed to do campaign events in Washington, D.C. He was then supposed to go to Florida. And he was also supposed to do a conference call. When all of that got scrapped, the one thing they left on his schedule was the conference call. But then we learned yesterday he didn't even take that. He had to get Mike Pence to take that conference call for him. So with exactly 1 month to go to the election, Donald Trump is in hospital. He is receiving treatment. We're being told the symptoms are mild. But whatever plans he had for campaigning, certainly in the short term, are absolutely gone, and some serious decisions to be made over the coming days and weeks.
Absolutely. Brian, I'll let you go. Many thanks for that. That's our US correspondent, Brian Donovan, bringing us the very latest on that from Washington. And there's been a lot of focus on the treatment that President Trump has been receiving. I'm joined on the line now by Professor Paddy Mallon, Professor of Microbial Diseases in the UCD School of Medicine, and also a consultant in infectious diseases in St. Vincent's University Hospital in Dublin. Paddy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yep, Paddy, as I say, a lot of focus on this drug in particular that we were told Donald Trump had received yesterday. It's an experimental antibody drug. What can you tell us about it?
Yes, to put a bit of background on this, so COVID-19, it's a disease that has a number of different stages. It's caused by a virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But you have a very early stage of the disease, which I suppose President Trump's probably going through at the moment, where a lot of the symptoms are actually driven by the virus. And then as it progresses, the more severe infection, the disease is actually driven more by the body's immune response to the virus rather than the virus itself. And then obviously if you get to a critical stage of infection where you require intensive care, that's when you start to get organs in the body affected. So your lungs start to fail, or maybe some of the other organs in your body start to fail. So the treatment for the infection is different for each stage of the infection. And at the very early stage, it makes sense that if the symptoms are being driven by the virus, that you would target treatments that would target the virus. And that's what these antibodies do. These autoantibodies, they're developed to attach onto the virus itself and stop the virus then attacking cells and infecting cells. It's an experimental treatment, as you say, but the early indications are that it could be very effective. Autoantibodies or neutralizing antibodies are being developed for a number of viral diseases, and they really are the future of therapeutics.
But given the, as you say, it's early stages in the development of this drug, were you surprised when you heard that they had used it and reached for it so soon in the treatment of the president?
Not really, to be honest with you. I think there's one thing for certain here, and you know, the president of the United States is going to be served by some of the best doctors in the world. I would imagine that the one thing about COVID-19 infection and the disease is that each individual, you need to look at each individual for their risk factors, for what's happening to them with their condition. And then as a physician, you can make the best call on what you think the best treatment is for that person based on their risk factors, based on their clinical picture. And I would imagine, given how well he would be served by the doctors and Walter Reed and by his personal physicians, that he'd be given the best advice. And I would imagine that the best decisions are being taken in terms of what is the best recommended treatment for the condition that he has at the moment.
And the other advice or the other drug that we understand he's been given is this other antiviral drug that we've heard quite a bit about as well, remdesivir, is it?
Yes, this is remdesivir. Remdesivir has been around for a while. It's made by a company called Gilead Sciences, and Gilead have been making antiviral medications for must be 20 years now. They've got a big presence in Ireland. They're really at the forefront of a lot of treatments for HIV infection. So they've got a strong track record. This drug was developed to stop viruses replicating. So if you start, again, very early in an infection like COVID-19, if you can give drugs that stop the virus replicating, you could maybe stop the disease progressing to more severe forms. It's given intravenously. It's been studied. They've had randomized controlled trials, which have shown some limited benefit. No impact in terms of overall mortality, but they've seen a shortening in the length of hospital stay.
Are we using it here, Paddy?
Yeah, we are. We're taking part in a large WHO-funded study. It's an international study called Solidarity, and remdesivir is part of that. So patients in Ireland that are coming into hospital with COVID-19 can access remdesivir as part of the trial. There's also limited access to remdesivir outside of the trial, but you know, as with everything in COVID, the access to these medications is still pretty limited.
Given, and I suppose a lot of people will be thinking this, looking at President Trump, given his age, we know he's 74, given, you know, he wouldn't be, I suppose, the picture of health in terms of his fitness levels and his weight. I mean, it must be a worrying time for himself and for his doctors.
I'm sure it is for himself and his family and his doctors. People really over the age of 45 and 50, if they get severe disease, they can easily end up hospitalized. Once you get really over the age of 65 is when you start to see a significant mortality risk associated with COVID-19 infection. And we've seen that even within Ireland, that the majority of deaths, unfortunately, that have occurred with this infection have occurred in people who are in that older age group. So it is a very worrying time for the president. I'm sure it's a very worrying time for the people in the United States, and we would all wish him a speedy and safe recovery.
And just to bring it back home, Paddy, we saw those numbers, the numbers being reported on both sides of the border at the moment now, very, very worrying, big spikes there. What are you seeing in Vincent's at the moment? What are you seeing there on the front line?
So we had a couple of months really where we saw very little activity with COVID-19, and that reflected the low rates of transmission within the community. Unfortunately now, since we've seen the community rates of transmission increase, we're seeing the knock-on effect. There's usually about a two-week lag between seeing increased rates in the community and seeing hospitalizations, because it takes about 10 days for people to transit through this early viral phase, through to this more immune phase, through to the end organ severe phase. So there's always that 10-day lag before we start seeing patients. And unfortunately, not only ourselves, but a lot of the hospitals around Dublin have seen an uptake in the number of people coming into hospital with severe infection. We've seen increases in the number of people entering the ICU. Not to the stage, thankfully, where we're seeing hospitals getting overrun. We're far from that. The hospitals are very well prepared for this. But it's as we see the trends heading in the wrong direction, it's concerning for two reasons. The first reason is, where does the trend end? You know, we really want to see this plateauing so that we know what we can deal with. And the second thing is that the more people in hospital with COVID-19, and particularly the more people in ICU with COVID-19, the greater there is for the potential impact on non-COVID services, because that's what we want to be doing day in, day out. We want to be catching up on all of the hospital services that we lost during the year. The more COVID-19 cases that we have in hospital, unfortunately, the greater the potential impact for those non-COVID services.
Given that level of concern that you and your colleagues would naturally have on the front line, would it be, do you think, time to consider putting the whole country on level three now, with, as you say, without any indication that those numbers, those case numbers are plateauing?
I think it's a worry. But having said that, I don't think that this is a scenario that can't be turned around and turned around quickly. But the only thing that's going to turn this around quickly is a community effort by everyone in the country. And I think what's happened in the United States, and particularly in the White House this week, shows us that this infection, it hasn't lost any of its infectivity. This infection spreads very easy. Hasn't lost any of its potency or its potential to cause severe disease, as we're seeing with what's happening in the White House at the minute. So our level of caution, we can't really let our guard down. The one thing that we do have in Ireland is we have a very educated population. We have a population that are used to the messages that are being given out by public health. We just need to increase that level of engagement with that. So for people this weekend, for example, as the chief medical officer said, take a step back. Cut down on the number of people that you're meeting. Simple measures like that can really interrupt transmission of this virus, and that could have a big onward impact, positive impact over the next week or two nationally, not just in terms of the numbers, but in terms of the hospitalizations. And it'll also help us to get our economy back on track. The other important component here is back in August when this kicked off, our testing, contact tracing, the capacity was relatively low, and I think it's fair to say that we were caught off guard. There's been a huge amount of work done over the last 8 to 9 weeks to get that up to speed, and it's much more efficient. It's got a much bigger capacity now than it did a few weeks ago. So even a small increased effort to get those numbers to turn the corner and reduce will enable that testing and isolating and investigating capacity to kick in. And a combination of the two of those, we may see improvements very quickly.
Okay.
But where we are at the minute, we just need everyone to make that extra bit of effort for the next couple of weeks to buy into the public health advice and get these numbers turned around.
Okay, I'll let you go, Paddy. Paddy Mallon there, Professor Paddy Mallon, Professor of Microbial Diseases in UCD and Consultant in St Vincent's University Hospital in Dublin. Thank you for that. Jack Chambers, if I can just go to you about those numbers, the virus numbers that we saw last night, 470 cases here, 934 cases in Northern Ireland. It feels like we're going backwards, doesn't it?
Well, the situation is really serious, and the trend is certainly going in the wrong direction, as Paddy said, and we saw the rapid increase in the north, and that's obviously affecting some of the border counties as well. I think, unfortunately, in the commentary around, you know, there's been some discussions that, you know, hospitalizations haven't reflected the increased number of cases that we've seen, but that pattern is now emerging. Professor Philip Nolan actually highlighted that in the last number of days, where the increased numbers of hospitalizations is mirroring the increased number of cases by 4 to 5% per day. So really, the message from government, and I think across politics, is that people need to follow the public health advice from the chief medical officer, reduce the number of contacts, try and break the transmission rate.
Can I just say that some of that commentary that you referred to there was included in an interview in The Currency with the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar this week, where he suggested that maybe we should look at what other countries are looking at doing, which is basing our restrictions not on case numbers but on the numbers of hospitalizations, because obviously the profile of the cases we're having has changed dramatically since the start of it. Is that what you're referring to when you said that?
Oh, not at all, no. I'm talking about the general commentary. In fairness, the Taoiseach was correct in saying that, and when you look at what NPHET actually examines when it gives its advice to government. It looks at clusters, it looks at the disease profile, it looks at the ICU capacity.
But the Taoiseach was suggesting we should do things differently.
Well, in fact, what he said is aligned with what's in the Resilience and Recovery Roadmap. And I think if you look at what NPHET actually examine when it makes recommendations to government, it looks at ICU capacity, it looks at the disease profile, it looks at the age cohorts.
He was suggesting
and the
we change the criteria we use in order to decide on what restrictions we should introduce.
The criteria he actually referenced are the criteria that NPHET examines. If you look at page 27 of the roadmap, it's very clear in that context. So I think it's correct that we look at a range of criteria when government is making decisions, and that is what's referenced in the 6 to 9 month resilience and recovery roadmap and how we live alongside COVID. But we are seeing that picture emerging where case numbers, we had 12 people in hospital with COVID in August. It's now 121 and rising. And that's going to have, as Paddy said, it's going to have a significant impact on our ability to do non-COVID related healthcare as we head into a difficult winter. So we need people to adhere to the public health advice, break the ongoing mode of transmission and try and turn the corner before a difficult winter emerges.
Richard Boyd Barrett.
Well, first of all, I think Donald Trump's infection and the rising rates that we're seeing should be a salutary reminder to anybody who was downplaying, including Donald Trump himself, the threat that COVID-19 represented, that it is a very real threat and that everybody has to take it extremely seriously. And that some of the political forces that he was encouraging, who were downplaying it and frankly being reckless, I hope they're put back in their box so that we can address this very serious crisis we're facing. The other thing, by the way, I think is important, arising out of Paddy Mallon's discussion and the discussion around Trump's treatment, and we're not talking enough about it, and it's something I raised at the COVID committee, is the amount of effort, resources, investment that's going into therapies. Because until we get a vaccine, we need to actually look at preventing people from dying. I mean, one project that the European Union is pursuing and there's trials going on all over the place is convalescent plasma therapy, using the blood of survivors of COVID-19 to basically activate the immune system of people who are very serious. And as far as I know, it could have been Paddy himself, who I'd love to ask him there, there was an application put in to be part of that project, the European Union project here, and the government didn't give the money, which is very disappointing. And now that may have changed and recently, maybe Jack could tell us, but I think that's very serious. We need to really invest in our scientists and in all the means necessary to develop therapies. And finally, then, I think we have to say, look, there has to be, as a lot of the experts have been saying, there has to be a serious and open discussion now about strategy for dealing with COVID. We have to stop the political management of data and information because...
What do you mean by that?
I mean that, we still don't know, for example, the considerations of NPHET and the expert advisory group are still only published months after, so we don't know what they're actually saying. There's a lot of...
Well, we do have the letter that the NPHET sent to the minister with their weekly advice after their meeting.
I was looking at the NPHET minutes today, right? And if you go on their website, and the last minutes were at the end of August, and the last expert advisory group minutes were back in July. And they're discussing very serious
things. They do put
things.
Themselves before the media 2 days a week.
We've had extreme difficulty. We've had one briefing with CMO and NPHET.
And they were before the committee and the Oireachtas committee
and
this week.
Very only after some of us, including myself, kicked up complaining that they hadn't come before us. And then we had very limited time to question them about the details in this. And there's a lot of people...
What do you think is being withheld from you? What do you believe we need to know that would help matters?
I think there's not a trusting in the intelligence. And Paddy Mallon is absolutely right. In the intelligence and wisdom of the people. Actually, when we were best combating this, it was when people really bought into the strategy. Since we opened up, and I think frankly we opened up too early, there hasn't been the same...
I didn't hear you saying that when we were opening
up.
Did
we? Absolutely. People for profit absolutely argued against an excessive acceleration towards reopening in workplaces in particular. And it's still not clear, I think, even though it's now clear, widespread community transmission, where did it continue to fester when we had it down to low levels? And it looks to me it was in workplaces in particular. I think we have to honestly look at the school issue as well. But I think we need an open debate about this. We need all the data and we need to hear the alternative strategies that have been put forward. I had a briefing in the Oireachtas this week with the zero COVID people like Sam McConkie, who are arguing if, as it looks like, we're going back to effective lockdown soon. If this trajectory continues, we have to consider, do we go for a zero COVID strategy? Because we can't just keep bouncing in and out of the sort of situation we're in at the moment.
Okay, I want to bring in Donnacha O'Leary, who's down in our Cork studio. Donnacha, at that point, that there was a lot of talk actually that Cork was facing into an upgrading of restrictions, going to perhaps level 3 this week because of the way the numbers are going there. What Richard Boyd Barrett has just said there, is it almost inevitable that we're heading back towards a national lockdown?
Look, I certainly hope so. Like, I mean, there was a lot of concern in Cork during the week, and I raised some of these concerns in the Dáil, and I know that they're still concerned because, of course, you know, like the behaviours that would have been happening this week, and I know that people actually did adjust their behaviour, certainly from my experience anyway, in talking to people around the city. That danger is obviously not gone, and you know, we'll have to look at the way things go over the next few weeks. Like, I mean, I do think to an extent we need to work in a positive way as best as we can, because obviously we can be looking at the one hand of the dangers in the entire state ending back in a lockdown. I also think, like, I mean, on the other hand, perhaps we should be looking at how we can get Donegal back down to level 2, how we can get other places back down to level 2. And for me, you know, we still are way, way behind in terms of testing. Obviously, that we welcome the fact that after a lot of pressure from ourselves and other people in the opposition, and indeed a lot of people in medicine, that there's additional people being recruited for swabbing, which will increase capacity, but we don't have increased capacity in terms of labs. So that is a bit of an issue there. And it's crucial to our ability to be able to, and, you know, a lot of the government talk is about living with the pandemic and how we manage that and the balance that's involved in that, but testing is a crucial part of that. I think the Taoiseach's Taoiseach's comments were very unfortunate, I have to say. And I think, look, I mean, it's not the first time that I think he's a bit broke from the government and seeking attention. And look, I don't know, the Chief Whip there is denying it, but I hope he is referring to the Taoiseach, and I hope the people in government are talking to the Taoiseach, because, like, I mean, I think he's missing the point, and I think he's undermining the public health advice in reality. Because, look, you look at our hospital system, and for years before now, without the pandemic, it is often on a precipice. It is often on a precipice when you head into the winter. And if you're waiting on cases in hospitals to reach a certain level at 40 or 50 or whatever it is, then it's too late. Then it's too late. And it's obviously, it's become very widespread in the community. So I do believe it has to be on the basis of testing and numbers in the community. If you're waiting for the hospital numbers to go up, then the pressure on the system is already too great.
Okay, let me put that to Jack Chambers.
I'm just a bit surprised by Donnacha in reference to Taoiseach. Taoiseach from the get-go in March has been at the forefront of adhering to public health advice from NPHET, and in fact one of the most unhelpful interventions.
No, hang on a second.
One of the most unhelpful interventions in the last number of weeks was actually from the Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald on the day when the disease trajectory in Dublin was heading in a really worrying space. We had the Sinn Féin leader in a really populist call look for every pub in the city to be reopened. And actually that intervention and that populist division around public health advice actually impacts the public health messaging on trying and that's a really important point.
It is a point.
And of course, they did a U-turn that evening on that issue when it became clear that public health advice needed to be followed. So I think it's a bit rich from Donnacha now to be playing
Jack,
that game.
Jack, like, I mean, if you like, the purpose of NPHET is to provide advice to government, and obviously it carries a great deal of weight, but it's never been suggested that it shouldn't be scrutinised, and they would say that themselves. It's a matter for government to apply the policy and to make decisions on it. There are tens of thousands of families who rely on pubs for their income. And as far as I'm concerned, and it is correct to say that there is nothing special about meals or anything like that, and government has recognised that.
Why did you do a U-turn on it at the day, though?
No, I don't believe that there was any U-turn.
I thought Sinn Féin backtracked on their... The morning they were saying, open every pub by evening, Mary Lou MacDonald did a specific U-turn after the public
health
advice.
And what she said was that people should follow the public health advice, and there's never any suggestion. When the public health advice there and it's given, then it should be, of course, followed. There's no question of that.
Can I just... That point, which was in fact discussed in this studio 2 weeks ago with Owen O'Brien, that point you're exactly making, Jack Chambers. But just to finish up that other point in relation to the Taoiseach, are you telling me that Fianna Fáil ministers have no issue whatsoever with the number of times which have been widely reported that Leo Varadkar made statements in relation to when pubs might reopen, in relation to the green list, and this week in relation to the criteria for restriction? You're saying that has not caused any issues at all at Cabinet with the Fianna Fáil side of Cabinet?
The Taoiseach has been very supportive of government measures and also around public health advice. And I think, in fact, his comments in recent days haven't reflected the content of what NPHET actually does. NPHET looks at ICU capacity, it looks at the critical care beds, it looks at a broader range of criteria when it is making recommendations to government. And he was
but
saying
the issue
that,
here is not what NPHET does, the Taoiseach said. But just before we leave this issue, can I ask you about that report in the Independent today saying that the government is looking at more supports for businesses that are directly impacted by the COVID restrictions?
Absolutely. In the context of Budget 2021, we have to ensure that we support the most vulnerable sectors of our economy, and many businesses, particularly in the tourism and hospitality sector, have obviously a very worrying picture in the coming weeks. But there's engagement. But I know the Minister for Tourism, Catherine Martin, is engaging with the two respective ministers in finance and public expenditure. And we have put a serious amount of supports already are into the public domain in the context of the €7 billion stimulus and many other supports. But we want to support businesses and protect employment. And that's the key focus of government.
And can businesses expect more of that solidly in the budget?
Well, obviously, the budget negotiations are ongoing, but the whole focus...
But obviously
of,
kites are being flown ahead of that.
The whole focus of government policy from when this government has been formed is to provide an enormous expenditure response to the difficulties that COVID-19 have represented, and that expenditure response will continue into next year.
Okay, and we're going to have to take a break there, but we'll be talking about the Leaving Cert calculated grades errors after these.
Tweet at SaturdayRTE.
Now to the debacle of the Leaving Cert calculated grades errors. Jack Chambers, first things first, because what every student out there right now today will want to know is, when are they going to get their grades confirmed?
Okay, so the first thing I'd like to say is obviously this has been an extremely difficult year for every Leaving Certificate student, and the government's priority right now is to remedy and rectify this, and that's what Minister Foley has done over the last number of days. So the I understand the report from the external oversight group who've come in to provide the process and have been appointed in the last number of days, that that's going to occur very shortly. When that report arrives at Minister Foley's desk, there'll be a process with the Calculated Grades Office which will finalise the changed results for anyone who's impacted, and then everybody will be contacted, and obviously those who get an upgrade will get that specific information, and then as soon as possible the CAO will then issue the update to whatever student is affected.
Offers.
Yes.
Okay, so because there had been some suggestion that review could have been completed as early as yesterday. Are we any idea now of when where we're at on the timeline?
I understand the review will be very shortly, so it could be as soon as today or tomorrow.
Okay, and they're working right through the weekend.
They're working right through the week, yeah.
Can I ask you, we put a number of questions, detailed questions, to the Department of Education, and I have some of their responses here in a statement. One of those is that they've told us that they do now plan to publish the source code, which is this broader, as part of a broader review of all the aspects of this calculated grades model. Jack, I mean, this was, like many aspects of this calculated grades model, this was like the third secret of Fatima. Do we now know when we're going to see this published?
Well, the first priority for government at the moment is to rectify and remedy the whole issue for anyone who's affected. And as you know, Minister Foley announced in the Dáil on Thursday night that there would also be an independent review of the whole process, which I think is important to state, because there has to be an examination of this. And look, all information related to this needs to be transparent, and that will occur once we address the difficulties that are presently on the desk of government, which is to deal with the issue with many students affected.
Okay, Donnacha O'Leary, you were calling for this code to be open source from very early on.
Absolutely, and look, I mean, obviously it's welcome that they will publish it at some stage, but to a large extent it is far too late. Really, the problem here is, like, I mean, this isn't a small error, this isn't a simple error, this is a fairly simple error, but it's had enormous consequences for students who Jack has rightly said, you know, had an awful year, but this has really compounded it. And I think the Department of Education needs to take a good hard look at itself here. Like, I mean, this should have been tested. It should have been certified that it works. It looked like it wasn't.
Well, let me just give you exactly what they told us in relation to that, because obviously we did ask about how the quality assurance checks. And here's what they told us. They said a number of data verification and quality assurance checks have been carried out by the department's Calculated Grades Executive Office. In addition, the Educational Research Centre had a role in validation and quality assurance. The ERC carried out a number of checks as part of the validation process. To do this, it relied on the statistical code, which is used to produce the Leaving Certificate results. This is based on, but different to, the original source code, which was written by Polymetrica. Samples of that code were spot checked and found to function correctly. So if I'm reading that right, and it's quite a complicated construction there, but it seems to me that the actual code that contained the errors, the one that was written by Polymetrica, was only spot checked. It was never fully checked before it was used to calculate the grades of 61,000 Leaving Cert students.
And I think that that's absolutely extraordinary. And look, the Educational Research Centre does fantastic work, but it's an academic body. It's not a software programming agency. Harold Hislop himself, the chief inspector in the department, has said a full trial of the model has not been run. So, like, look, the department bought an application that didn't work. And it's you know, checking this is not complicated. You have your formula, you take a small data set, for example, 20 students, a dozen students, whatever. You run that through the formula. You should know what the outcome is meant to be. You know what the formula is meant to do. And if it doesn't produce the result that you expected, you work back through that. So the department has bought a dud here. There's questions need to be asked about that. It wasn't tendered. Polymetrica was chosen because it worked on in the past. Was any of that work remotely comparable? It looks like Polymetrica is a bit of a one-man band. The oversight obviously wasn't working. And this has not only cost money, it's cost significant money. And that's why we're asking for this to be examined by the Public Accounts Committee. But it's had huge implications for at least 6,500 students, perhaps more than that. Perhaps more flaws will emerge. I certainly hope not. It simply is not good enough. And it's caused a lot of hurt and anxiety. And it really is an absolute mess.
OK, Richard Boy Barrett.
Well, the first thing that has to happen is that anybody who got lower grades and they should have actually got need to have those grades, that problem identified. They need to get the correct grades and they need to get into the courses that they chose, and the government have to put the resources into ensuring that happens.
Yeah, but we
that
know that there will be some cases where that simply won't be possible, because a lot of those courses are already stuffed to the gills because of the inflation, grade inflation that had already occurred.
Yeah, and more importantly, the chronic underfunding of third level education in this country, the lack of places and a fundamentally dysfunctional system of entry into third level education, which the Leaving Cert at the best of times is a rotten system as far as I'm concerned, which is about rationing places in third level education rather than actually allowing people to enter third level education. We have deep inequality in access to third level in this country, and that reinforces deep inequalities in our society. I'd also say, in terms of the origins of this, I mean, People for Profit were the first people to say the Leaving Cert should be cancelled when a lot of school students were screaming for it. The government dithered around that. Then they dithered around the predictive grades because they wanted to essentially underpin an already unequal system in terms of certain schools getting historically better results. And I think all of that dithering by the government government has also led to a rushed situation, which produced the mess we now have around the calculated grades. And I mean, it does shine a light on really a fundamentally dysfunctional system and poor management of this crisis from the outset by the government.
Jack, very quickly.
Well, just to say that there will be an independent review process, which I think is important. So we examined some of the pertinent points that both Dunica and Richard have raised. But the focus of government right now is to do what others have stated, which is to remedy and rectify this in the context of...
It's a terrible mess, though, isn't it? I mean, really, you could hardly design a greater mess to land yourselves in and to land 61,000 students.
But in fairness, the political... leadership that Minister Foley has shown from when this error was identified was to move quickly, bring in an external process to rectify it, and then work with Minister Harris to actually get as many places as possible. And government will do everything to resource that. I have a brother myself who was leaving CERT this year.
But go back. Sorry, from that point is fine. But go back to that point that I raised about the testing. The fact that it appears from this statement that we got from the department that it was just spot checks that were run on the actual code that was used to do this hugely unprecedented, massively important job.
And that's why there will have to be, and there is going to be, an independent review process. This was the first time the department conducted a task like this around predicted grades. Obviously, they moved quickly to design that. They had contingency planning around it. But we will need to see why the errors occurred, and there'll have to be a full examination of that. And that's why the minister announced that in the Dáil on Thursday.
Okay,
and that's an important
piece.
Just to say, it also underlines the demand of the students that all registration fees should be absolutely waived.
Well, I want to go to the students now, because I have Lorna Fitzpatrick, President of the Students' Union of Ireland, on the line. Good afternoon, Lorna.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Lorna, I think that everyone's heart goes out to the Leaving Cert class of 2020 at this stage. They've had such a raw deal on all sorts of levels. What are the main considerations now for students, as this debacle rolls on?
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct. I think Leaving Cert students have had the rug pulled from under them time and time again this year, and it's just simply not fair. I'd have to say I agree with everything that Richard has, all the points that Richard has made there in relation to the inequalities in the education system and the chronic underfunding that has happened over the last decade and more. But in terms of the issues as they are at the moment, and I think we need to focus on how we can support students moving forward. And there's two things really at play here. The first is that if students are not going to be able to receive offers for the course that they should have had in the first place for this academic year, we need to know what's going to happen for those students. How is the government going to support them? And I think there's two points in relation to that. The first is that the free fees initiative, which results in students still having to pay €3,000 fees, which is the highest in the EU, that there's a rule embedded within that system that says that the government won't cover, the free fees initiative does not cover anyone for a repeat period of study. So if a student continues on their course this year that they have already started but are entitled to start the course that they should have received next year, will they have to pay additional fees in relation to that? And that same rule applies for SUSE grant aid. So how are they going to be financially supported throughout next year if they continue in the course that they've already started this year? And the second point is also in relation to accommodation. And we know that many students have signed leases. Many have moved to the towns and cities where their colleges are now based. And if they receive new offers either for this year or for next year, then what do they do with those leases? We've seen back in March when we were pleading with private providers to offer refunds to students when they were in lockdowns. And many of them didn't do that. So we need to know what supports are going to be there for those students. Are government going to ensure that no student is left out of pocket as a result of this huge, massive error that has had such an impact on these students?
Is there a concern as well, Lorna, in relation to, we've been talking a lot about the number of students who may now be in courses that they won't ultimately be in, that they will be offered higher choices if their grades are upgraded with this process. But what about, we also know that there is an unknown number of students who perhaps got grades that are higher than the ones that they should ultimately have received, and that maybe they are in courses now and have got in ahead of people who deserved those places ahead of them.
I think this all comes back to one of the points that Richard had made in relation to the Leave Insert, and the fact that it is a really, I suppose, competitive-based system that really isn't supportive for students in the broader sense. And I do think we need to have a long, hard look at the Leave Insert system and the competitive-based nature of the Leave Insert and the CAO system, and have a strong look at that and really look to reform that moving forward. But it's most difficult on all students across the board, and especially, I think, the vast majority of them don't know how this is going to impact them. They don't know if they have been impacted, and the lack of communication there is really concerning. And I think this needs to happen, and that communication needs to be out to those students as quickly as possible. We can't be left in limbo in this.
And speaking of communication issues, I know, because I spoke to you on Late Debate earlier this week, and you were very critical of how late in the day it was left to tell students to put the word out that you were not going to be, that college was going to be delivered remotely for the first 3 mm-hmm. weeks of college. There's now another week of that 3 weeks to run. Have you been given any indication of whether that situation is going to roll on, or if students are going to be welcomed back into lecture halls in a week's time?
No, we've had no clear communication on that. And again, that's a major issue with those restrictions due to end on the coming days. The numbers, as was reported in the first half of your show, the numbers are continuing to rise, and that's really concerning for us. And we don't want to see a situation like we've seen in the UK and in the US. And we are now at a fork in the road when it comes to our how we progress with this in terms of higher education. And we have a choice to make, and we need to make sure that we don't follow in the footsteps that see hundreds of students in student accommodation blocks testing positive. There was a case yesterday in a UK university where 770 cases were reported yesterday from one student accommodation block, and 78 of those students were displaying symptoms. So we need to have a strong look at this, and we really need to make a decision and do that as early as possible. We can't be having Friday afternoon decisions that affect a Monday morning. People had already moved. It's already a confusing situation. So we need clarity for the remainder of this semester, to be quite honest.
Okay. Jack, do you want to respond to Lorna there?
Yeah, no, look, Lorna, I appreciate many of the points you've made. Just to say on the first point, if a student in a course opts for a deferral and they are given an upgrade, they can stay in the existing course and they'll have full eligibility for free fees and SUSE next year. So that's just to give some certainty to anyone who will have an uplift. I take the point regarding whether people are online or on campus. I think that will be reflective of where the current health pandemic is at, and Minister Harris will be engaging with yourselves in the coming days. And just to say, and from a broad government perspective, we recognise that there has to be increased funding for third level. That's why a new Department of Further and Higher Education has been established to focus on research and support for our third level institutions. And we want to see increased investment in that and embrace new opportunities over the coming years and support students. But we recognise this has been a really difficult year for the Leaving Cert class of 2020. As I said, my youngest brother was in that class as well, and I know the impact it has had on many people of that particular cohort. So we'll do everything we can, as I said, to rectify and remedy this current situation, and I appreciate how difficult it is.
Okay. We'll move on from that now. Thank you for joining us with that. That's Lorna Fitzpatrick there, who joined us from, she's the president of USI. Now I want to move on because, of course, one of the sectors that has been really hit the hardest, or possibly the hardest out of all the sectors, is the hospitality sector. So many people have lost their jobs, so many businesses now on their knees. A lot of them will be looking to the budget coming up for extra supports and what's there for them. And of course, the big initiative that was supposed to be a big support to this industry, the Spend and Save initiative, went live this week. But in the context of the restrictions that many parts of the country are in, is that really a realistic option now? Is that the way to go forward for this industry? I want to bring in Elena Fitzgerald-Kane, President of the Irish Hotels Federation and a hotelier yourself. Good afternoon, Elena.
Good afternoon, Katie. Thank you for inviting me on today.
Yeah, Elaine, just give us a snapshot of what business across the country in the hotel industry is like at the moment.
Okay, so I suppose the first thing to say is prior to COVID, our tourism and hospitality had 270,000 jobs. So as it stands right now, 100,000 jobs are gone and 100,000 jobs are at immediate risk. And look, that 270,000 jobs was actually 1 in 10 of all jobs. So huge So as we look into, I suppose, the winter months ahead, as it stands right now, there's only 11% occupancy in November. There's 22% in October. So what little base we have will be having. And indeed, even at the height of the summer, it was actually only one in every two rooms were occupied. So look, there's huge revenue drops. If you were in Dublin or Donegal right now, it would be 95% drop in revenue. It's about 70% across the country. So there is that real sense that our sector is being very much disproportionately, I suppose, restricted and affected. And at the end of the day, you know, there's a real growing sentiment of tourism jobs count and just how important the budget is.
Okay, what do you want in the budget?
So from a budget perspective, the first thing is the employment wage subsidy scheme. I mean, that's the reason why every hospitality business is open. So we're looking for it to be, I suppose, restored to TWSS levels. It needs to be ran from March and it needs to be paid weekly. It's currently monthly. It was weekly. And for some businesses, that could be €100,000 that you just don't, €100,000 that you just don't have. Other things would be a 12-month rates waiver. Quite simply, we don't have the money to pay it. VAT at 9% would create a demand stimulus, and particularly given that there's only one country in Europe that has a higher VAT rate than us, and liquidity measures. So in terms of bank deferments, grants, they're all critical pieces. And as you very correctly mentioned earlier on, I suppose, in terms of the stay and spend scheme, it was very well intentioned as a thank you. It built in the great value that was available, built in staycation experiences. But, you know, with two counties in level three, you know, a quasi lockdown, you know, all the business that comes from Dublin, how that ricochets throughout the country, you know, messaging from government, confidence. There's just so many reasons why that needs to be looked at.
OK, we're very close to the time here, so I want to let Jack respond to that.
No, I thank you, Elaine, for many of the points that have been raised. I mean, there is an acknowledgement in government that it's been a really challenging time for the hospitality and tourism sector, and hospitality and tourism sector provide huge amount of employment across the country and in regions and towns. And the Stay and Spend initiative is being monitored closely by both Ministers Dunhu and Martin, and it was an initiative introduced in the summer. But we are looking, and there's engagement with all the sectors in the tourism and hospitality space around framing Budget 2021, and there'll obviously be ongoing engagement over the coming week. But we have injected...
But we're telling people not to go anywhere, really, now, with the spend and save thing.
The stimulus, though, provided like significant supports in terms of the restart grant. We have the, as I said, the employment wage subsidy
scheme. What
about the
VAT rate issue?
Well, the VAT, that the higher level of VAT was reduced as part of the stimulus from 23% to 21%. And look, the Minister of Finance is framing the budget for next year. The expenditure response has been extraordinary this year, and there'll be ongoing supports for many of the exposed sectors next year as well. And that's the whole budgetary process as we see it. And we have significant engagement with the Hotels Federation and others so that we protect employment and businesses through the pandemic.
Okay, that's it. That's all we have time for this week. Apologies, I didn't get to go back to the rest of the panel with that. But that's, as I say, all we have time for. I will see you again on Tuesday night on Late Debate, and we'll be back here in the studio next Saturday at 1 o'clock.
Saturday with Katie Hannon. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.
And Saturday with Katie Hannon was produced by Mary O'Hagan. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Research was by Andrew Fleming. And sound was by Tommy O'Sullivan.